She began by telling him about a 15-year-old girl who'd felt extraordinarily pretty with a pink ribbon tied in her hair, and how this girl had gone to a varsity basketball game one night only because her future homemakers meeting had been canceled at the last minute, and she had 2 hours to kill before her father came and picked her up. Or maybe, she said, she just wanted people to see how pretty she looked, wearing that ribbon, and the school library was empty. A boy in a letter jacket had sat down beside her in the bleachers, a big boy with broad shoulders, a senior who would have been out there running up and down the court with the rest of them if he hadn't been kicked off the team in December for fighting. She went on, listening to her mouth spill out things she had been positive she would take untold with her to her grave. Not about the tennis racket, that one she would take untold to her grave, but about how Norman had bitten her on their honeymoon, and how she had tried to persuade herself it was a love bite, and about the Norman-assisted miscarriage, and about the crucial differences between face-hitting and back-hitting. "So I have to pee a lot," she said, smiling nervously down at her own hands. "But that's getting better." She told him about the times early in her marriage when he had burned her toes or the tips of her fingers with his cigarette lighter. Hilariously enough, that particular torment had ceased when Norman quit smoking. She told him about the night Norman had come home from work, sat silently in front of the TV during the news, holding his dinner on his lap but not eating it, how he had put his plate aside when Dan Rather had finished, and how he had begun poking her with the tip of a pencil that had been lying on the table at one end of the couch. He poked hard enough to hurt and leave little black dots like moles on her skin, but not quite hard enough to draw blood. She told Bill there were other times when Norman had hurt her worse, but that he had never scared her more. Mostly it was his silence. When she talked to him, tried to find out what was wrong, he wouldn't reply. He only kept walking after her as she retreated. She hadn't wanted to run. That would very likely have been like dropping a sulfur match into a barrel of gunpowder. Not answering her questions and ignoring her outstretched, splay-fingered hands. He kept poking her arms and her shoulders and her upper chest. She had been wearing one of those shell tops with a mildly scooped neck, with a pencil, and making a little plosive noise under his breath every time the pencil's blunt point dug into her skin. At last she had been huddled in the corner with her knees up against her breasts and her hands laced over the back of her head, and he had been kneeling in front of her, his face serious, almost studious. And he kept poking her with a pencil and making that noise. She told Bill that by then she was sure he was going to kill her, that she was going to be the only woman in the history of the world to be stabbed to death with a Mongol number 2 pencil. And what she remembered telling herself over and over again was that she mustn't scream because the neighbors would hear, and she didn't want to be found this way. Not still alive, at least. It was too shameful. Then, just as she was nearing the point where she knew she was going to begin screaming in spite of herself, Norman had gone into the bathroom and shut the door. He was in there a long time. And she had thought about running then, just running out the door and into the anywhere. But it had been night, and he had been in the house. If he had come out and found her gone, she said, he would have chased her and caught her and killed her. She knew it. "He would have snapped my neck like the wishbone in a chicken," she told Bill without looking up. She had promised herself that she would leave, though. She would do it the very next time he hurt her. But after that night, he hadn't laid a hand on her for a long time. 5 months, maybe. And when he did go after her again, at first it hadn't been so bad, and she had told herself that if she could stand up to being poked over and over again with a pencil, she could put up with a few punches. She had gone on thinking that until 1985, when things had suddenly escalated. She told him how scary Norman had been that year, because of the trouble with Wendy Yarrow. "That was the year you had your miscarriage, wasn't it?" Bill asked. "Yes," she told her hands. "He broke one of my ribs, too, or maybe it was a couple. I don't really remember anymore. Isn't that awful?" He didn't reply, So she hurried on, telling him that the worst parts, other than the miscarriage, of course, were the long, scary silences when he would simply look at her, breathing so loudly through his nose that he sounded like an animal getting ready to charge. Things had gotten a little better, she said, after her miscarriage. She told him about how she had started to slip a few cogs at the end, how time sometimes got away from her when she was in her rocker, and how sometimes, when she was setting the table for supper and listening for the sound of Norman's car pulling into the driveway, she'd realize she'd taken 8 or even 9 showers in the course of the day, usually with the bathroom lights off. I like to shower in the dark, she said, still not daring to look up from her hands. It was like a wet closet. She finished by telling him about Anna's call, which Anna had made in a hurry for one important reason. She had learned a detail which hadn't been in the newspaper story, a detail the police were holding back to help them weed out any false confessions or bad tips they might receive. Peter Slowick had been bitten over 3 dozen times, and at least one part of his anatomy was missing. The police believed that the killer had taken it with him, one way or another. Anna knew from therapy circle that Rosie McClendon, whose first significant contact in the city had been with her ex-husband, had been married to a biter. There might be no connection, Anna had been quick to add, but, on the other hand, a biter, Bill said quietly. It sounded almost as if he were talking to himself. Is that what they call men like him? Is that the term? I guess it is, Rosie said. And then, maybe because she was afraid he wouldn't believe her, would think she had been fibulating, in Norman speak, she slid her shoulder briefly out of the pink tape engine t-shirt she was wearing and showed him the old white ring of scar there, like the remnant of a shark bite. That had been the first one, her honeymoon present. Then she turned up her left forearm, showing him another. This time it wasn't a bite it made her think of. For some reason it made her think of smooth white faces almost hidden in lush green undergrowth. This one bled quite a bit, then got infected, she told him. She spoke in the tone of someone relaying routine information, that Grandma had called earlier, perhaps, or that the mailman had left a package. I didn't go to the doctor, though. Norman brought home a big bottle of antibiotic tablets. I took them and got better. He knows all sorts of people he can get things from. He calls people like that Daddy's little helpers. That's sort of funny when you think of it, isn't it? She was still talking mostly to her hands, which were clasped in her lap. But she finally dared a quick look up at him to gauge his reaction to the things she had been saying. What she saw stunned her. What? He asked hoarsely. What, Rosie? You're crying, she said, and now her own voice wavered. Bill looked surprised. No, I'm not. At least, I don't think I am. She reached out with one finger, drew a gentle semicircle below his eye with it, and then held the tip up for him to see. He examined it closely, biting his lower lip. You didn't eat much either. Half of his dog was still on his plate, with mustardy sauerkraut spilling out of the bun. Bill pitched the paper plate into the trash barrel beside the bench, then looked back at her, absently wiping at the wetness on his cheeks. Rosie felt a bleak certainty steal over her. Now he would ask why she had stayed with Norman, and while she wouldn't get up off the park bench and leave, any more than she had ever left the house on Westmoreland Street until April, it would put the first barrier between them, because it was a question she couldn't answer. She didn't know why she had stayed with him, any more than she knew why, in the end, it had taken just a single drop of blood to transform her entire life. She only knew that the shower had been the best place in the house, dark and wet and full of steam, and that sometimes half an hour in Pooh's chair felt like 5 minutes, and that why wasn't a question that had any meaning when you were living in hell. Hell was motiveless. The women in therapy circle had understood that, No one had asked her why she stayed. They knew. From their own experiences, they knew. She had an idea that some of them might even know about the tennis racket, or things even worse than the tennis racket. But when Bill finally asked a question, it was so different from the one she had expected that for a moment she could only flounder. What are the chances he might have killed the woman who was making all the trouble for him back in 85? That Wendy Yarrow. She was shocked, but it wasn't the kind of shock one feels when asked an unthinkable question. She was shocked in the manner of one who sees a known face in some fabulously unlikely locale. The question he had spoken aloud was one which had circled, unarticulated and thus not quite formed, at the back of her mind for years. Rosie, I asked you what you thought the chances were. I think they might have been, well, pretty good, actually. It was convenient for him when she died like that, wasn't it? Saved him from watching the whole thing get hung out in civil court. Yes. If she had been bitten, do you think the newspapers would have printed it? I don't know, maybe not. She looked at her watch and got quickly to her feet. Oh, boy, I have to go, and right now. Rhoda wanted to start in again at 12:15, and it's 10 past already. They started back, side by side. She found herself wishing he would put his arm around her again, and just as part of her mind was telling her not to be greedy, and another part, practical, sensible, was telling her not to ask for trouble, he did just that. I think I'm falling in love with him. It was the lack of amazement in that thought which prompted the next one. No, Rosie, I think that's actually yesterday's headline. I think it's already happened. What did Anna say about the police? He asked her. Does she want you to go someplace and make a report? She stiffened within the circle of his arm, her throat drying out as adrenaline tipped into her system. All it took was that single word, the P word. Cops are brothers, Norman had told her this over and over. Law enforcement is a family, and cops are brothers. Rosie didn't know how true it was, how far they would go to stick up for each other, or cover up for each other. But she knew that the cops Norman brought home from time to time seemed eerily like Norman himself. And she knew he had never said a word against any of them. Even his first partner on detectives, a crafty, grafty old pig named Gordon Satterwaite, whom Norman had loathed. And, of course, there was Harley Bissington, whose hobby, at least when in attendance at Casa Daniels, had been undressing Rosie with his eyes. Harley had gotten some kind of skin cancer and taken early retirement 3 years ago. But he had been Norman's partner back in 1985, when the Richie Bender-Wendy Yarrow thing had gone down. And if it had gone down the way Rosie suspected it had, then Harley had stuck up for Norman, stuck up for him big time. And not just because he'd been in on it himself, either. He'd done it because law enforcement was a family, and cops were brothers. Cops saw the world in a different way from the nine-to-fivers, the Kmart shoppers, in Norman speak. Cops saw it with its skin off and its nerves sizzling. It made all of them different. It made some of them a lot different. And then there was Norman. I'm not going anywhere near the police, Rosie said, speaking rapidly. Anna said I don't have to, and nobody can make me. The police are his friends, his brothers. They stick up for each other. They take it easy, he said, sounding a little alarmed. It's okay, just take it easy. I can't take it easy. I mean, you don't know. That's really why I called you and said I couldn't see you, because you don't know how it is, how he is, and how it works between him and all the rest of them. If I went to the police here, they would check with the police there. And if one of them, someone who works with him, who's been on stakeouts with him at 3 in the morning, who's trusted his life to him... It was Harley she was thinking of, Harley who couldn't stop looking at her breasts and always had to check on where the hem of her skirt finished up when she sat down. Rosie, you don't have to... Yes, I do, she said with a fierceness that was entirely unlike her. If a cop like that knew how to get in touch with Norman, he would. He'd say I'd been talking about him. If I gave them my address, and they make you do that when you file a complaint, he'd give him that, too. I'm sure that no cop would... Have you ever had them in your house, playing poker or watching Debbie Does Dallas? Well, no, but I have. I've heard what they talk about, and I know how they look at the rest of the world. They see it that way, as the rest of the world. Even the best of them do. There's them, and there's the Kmart shoppers. That's all. He opened his mouth to say something, he wasn't sure what, then closed it again. The idea that Norman might find out the address of her room on Trenton Street as the result of some cop's jungle telegraph had a sort of persuasiveness to it, but this was not the main reason he kept quiet. The look on her face, the look of a woman who has made a hateful and unwilling regression back to an unhappier time, suggested that he could say nothing which would convince her anyway. She was scared of the cops, that was all, and he was old enough to know that not all bogeys can be slain by mere logic. Besides, Anna said I didn't have to. Anna said if it was Norman, they'd be seeing him first, not me. Bill thought it over and decided it made sense. What will she do about it? She's already started. She faxed a women's group back home, where I came from anyway, and told them what might be happening here. She asked them if they could send her any information about Norman, and they faxed back a whole bunch of stuff just an hour later, including a picture. Bill raised his eyebrows. Fast work, especially after business hours. My husband is now a hero back home, she said dully. Probably hasn't had to pay for a drink in a month. He was in charge of the team that broke up a big drug ring. His picture was on the front page of the paper, 2 or 3 days running. Bill whistled. Maybe she wasn't so paranoid after all. The woman who took Anna's request went a step further, Rosie continued. She called the police department and asked if she could speak to him. She spun a big story about how her group wanted to give him a Women's Commendation Award. He considered this, then burst out laughing. Rosie smiled wanly. The duty sergeant checked his computer and said that Lieutenant Daniels was on vacation, somewhere out west, he thought. But he could be vacationing here, Bill said thoughtfully. Yes, and if someone gets hurt, it'll be all my He put his hands on her shoulders and swung her around. Her eyes flew wide and he saw the beginning of a cringe. It was a look that hurt his heart in a new, strange way. He suddenly remembered a story he had heard at the Zion American Center, where he had gone to religious study classes in USY until he was 9. Something about how, back in the days of the prophets, people had sometimes been stoned to death. At the time, he had thought it the most fabulously cruel form of punishment ever invented, much worse than the firing squad or the electric chair, a form of execution which could never be justified. Now, seeing what Norman Daniels had done to this lovely woman with her fragile, vulnerable face, he wondered. "Don't say fault," he told her. "You didn't make Norman." She blinked, as if this were a thought which had never occurred to her before. How in God's name could he have found this guy Slowick in the first place?
By being me, she said.
Bill looked at her. She nodded.
It sounds crazy, but it's not. He can really do that. I've seen him do it. It's probably how he busted that drug ring back home.
Hunch? Intuition?
More, it's almost like telepathy. He calls it trolling.
Bill shook his head. We're talking about a seriously strange guy, aren't we? That surprised her into a little laugh.
Oh, boy, you don't have any idea. Anyway, the women at DNS have all seen his picture and they'll be taking special precautions, especially at the picnic on Saturday. Some of them will be carrying mace, the ones who might actually remember to use it in a jackpot situation, Anna says. And that was all sounding good to me, but then she said... Don't worry, Rosie, we've been through scares like this before. And that turned it around again, because when a man gets killed, a nice man like the one that rescued me in that horrible bus station, it's not just a scare. Her voice was rising, picking up speed again. He took her hand and stroked it. "I know, Rosie," he said, in what he hoped was a soothing voice. "I know it's not." "She thinks she knows what she's doing. Anna, I mean. That she's been through this before just because she's called the cops on some drunk man who threw a brick through one of the windows or hung around and spit on his wife when she came out to pick up the morning paper. But she's never been through anything like Norman, and she doesn't know it, and that's what scares me." She paused, working to get control of herself, then smiled up at him. "Anyway, she says I don't have to be involved at all, at least not at this point."
"I'm glad."
The corn building was just ahead now.
"You didn't say anything about my hair."
She looked up again, a quick, shy glance this time. "Does that mean you didn't notice it, or you don't like it?"
He glanced at it and grinned. "I did notice it, and I do like it. But I had this other thing on my mind, being afraid I might never see you again, I mean."
"I'm sorry you were so upset."
She was, but she was also glad he had been upset. Had she ever felt even remotely like this when she and Norman had been courting? She couldn't remember. She had a clear memory of him feeling her up under a blanket at a stock car race one night, but for the moment, at least, everything was lost in a haze.
"You got the idea from the woman in the painting, didn't you? The one you bought the day I met you."
"Maybe," she said cautiously. "Did he think that was strange, and was that maybe the real reason he hadn't said anything about her hair?" But he surprised her again, perhaps this time even more than when he had asked about Wendy Yarrow.
"When most women change their hair color, what they look like is women who've changed their hair color," he said. "Most times men pretend they don't know that, but they do. But you, it's like the way your hair looked when you came into the shop was a dye job, and this is the way it really is. Probably that sounds like the most outrageous con you've ever heard, but it's the truth. And blondes usually look the least realistic. You ought to braid it, like the woman in the picture, too, though. It'd make you look like a Viking princess. Sexy as hell."
That word hit a big red button inside her, kicking off sensations that were both powerfully attractive and terribly alarming. "I have never liked sex. But..."
Rhoda and Kurt were walking toward them from the other direction. The four of them met in front of the corn building's elderly revolving doors. Rhoda's eyes scanned Bill up and down with bright curiosity.
"Bill, these are the people I work with," Rosie said.
Instead of subsiding, the heat continued to rise in her cheeks. "Rhoda Simons and Curtis Hamilton. Rhoda, Kurt, this is..." For one brief, abysmally black second, she found herself completely unable to remember the name of this man who had already meant so much to her. Then, thankfully, it came. "Bill Steiner," she finished.
"Good to meet you," Kurt said and shook Bill's hand. He glanced toward the building, clearly ready to slide his head back between the earphones.
"Any friend of Rosie's, as the saying goes," Rhoda said and held out her own hand. The slim bracelets on her wrist jangled mutedly.
"My pleasure," Bill said and turned back to Rosie. "Are we still on for Saturday?"
She thought furiously, then nodded.
"I'll pick you up at 8:30. Remember to dress warm."
"I will."
She could feel the blush spreading all the way down her body now, turning her nipples hard and even making her fingers tingle. The way he was looking at her hit that hot button again, but this time it was more attractive than scary. She was suddenly struck by an urge, comical but amazingly strong nevertheless, to put her arms around him and her legs, and then simply climb him like a tree.
"Well, I'll see you then," Bill said. He bent forward and pecked the corner of her mouth. "Rhoda, Curtis, it was nice to meet you." He turned and walked off, whistling.
"I'll say this for you, Rosie. Your taste is excellent," Rhoda said. "Those eyes."
"We're just friends," Rosie said awkwardly. "I met him..."
She trailed off. Suddenly explaining how she had met him seemed complicated, not to mention embarrassing. She shrugged, laughed nervously.
"Well, you know."
"Yes, I do," Rhoda said, watching Bill's progress up the street. Then she turned back to Rosie and laughed delightedly. I do know. Within this old wreck of femininity, there beats the heart of a true romantic. One who hopes you and Mr. Steiner will be very good friends. Meantime, are you ready to go back at it?
Yes, Rosie said.
Are we going to see an improvement over this morning now that you've got your other business more or less in order?
I'm sure there will be a big improvement, Rosie said. And there was.
The Temple of the Bull. Before going to bed that Thursday night, Rosie plugged in her new phone again and used it to call Anna. She asked if Anna had heard anything new or if anyone had seen Norman in the city. Anna gave a firm no to both questions, told her all was quiet, and then offered the old one about no news being good news. Rosie had her doubts about that, but kept them to herself. Instead, she offered Anna hesitant condolences on the loss of her ex-husband, wondering if Miss Manners had rules for handling such situations.
Thanks, Rosie, Anna said.
Peter was a strange and difficult man. He loved people, but he wasn't very lovable himself.
He seemed very nice to me.
I'm sure. To strangers, he was the Good Samaritan. To his family and the people who tried to be his friends, I belong to both groups, so I know, he was more like the Levite who passed by on the other side. Once, during Thanksgiving dinner, he picked up the turkey and threw it at his brother Hal. I can't remember for sure what the argument was about, but it was probably either the PLO or Cesar Chavez. It was usually one or the other. Anna sighed. There's going to be a remembrance circle for him Saturday afternoon. We all sit around in folding chairs, like drunks at an AA meeting, and take turns talking about him. At least I think that's what we do.
It sounds nice.
Do you think so? Anna asked. Rosie could imagine her arching her eyebrows in that unconsciously arrogant way of hers and looking more like Maud than ever. I think it sounds rather silly, but perhaps you're right. Anyway, I'll leave the picnic long enough to do that, but I'll come back with only a few regrets. The battered women of this city have lost a friend. There's no doubt about that much.
If it was Norman who did it.
I knew that was coming, Anna said. I've been working with women who've been bent, folded, stapled, and mutilated for a lot of years, and I know the masochistic grandiosity they develop. It's as much a part of the battered woman syndrome as the dissociation and the depression. Do you remember when the space shuttle Challenger exploded?
Yes. Rosie was mystified, but she remembered all right.
Later that day, I had a woman come to me in tears. There were red marks all over her cheeks and arms. She'd been slapping and pinching herself. She said it was her fault those men and that nice woman teacher had died. When I asked why, she explained she'd written not one but two letters supporting the manned space program, one to the Chicago Tribune and one to the U.S. representative from her district. After a while, battered women start accepting the blame, that's all. And not just for some things, either. For everything. Rosie thought of Bill walking her back to the corn building with his arm around her waist. Don't say fault, he'd told her. You didn't make Norman. I didn't understand that part of the syndrome for a long time, Anna said. But now I think I do. Someone has to be to blame, or all the pain and depression and isolation make no sense. You go crazy. Better to be guilty than crazy. But it's time for you to get past that choice, Rosie.
I don't understand.
Yes, you do, Anna said calmly. And from there, they had passed on to other subjects. 20 minutes after saying goodbye to Anna, Rosie lay in bed with her eyes open and her fingers laced together under her pillow, looking up into the darkness as faces floated through her mind like untethered balloons. Rob Lefferts, looking like Mr. Pennybags on the yellow community chess cards. She saw him offering her one that said, "Get out of jail, free." Rhoda Simons, with a pencil stuck in her hair, telling Rosie it was nylon stockings, not nylon strokings. Gert Kinshaw, a human version of the planet Jupiter, wearing sweatpants and a man's V-necked undershirt, both size extra, extra, extra large. Cynthia someone, Rosie still couldn't quite remember her last name, the cheerful punk rocker with a two-tone hair, saying she had once sat for hours in front of a picture where the river had actually seemed to be moving. And Bill, of course. She saw his hazel eyes with the green undertints, saw the way his dark hair grew back from his temples, saw even the tiny circle of scar on his right earlobe, which he'd once had pierced, perhaps back in college, as the result of a drunken dare, and then allowed to grow back over. She felt the touch of his hand on her waist, warm palm, strong fingers, felt the occasional brush of her hip against his, and wondered if he had been excited touching her. She was now willing to admit that the touch had certainly excited her. He was so different from Norman that it was like meeting a visitor from another star system. She closed her eyes, drifted deeper. Another face came floating out of the darkness. Norman's face. Norman was smiling, but his gray eyes were as cold as chips of ice. "I'm trolling for you, sweetie," Norman said. "Lying in my own bed, not all that far away, and trolling for you. Pretty soon I'll be talking to you. Right up close, I'll be talking to you. Should be a fairly short conversation. And when it's over..." He raised his hand. There was a pencil in it, a Mongol number 2. It had been sharpened to a razor point. "This time, I won't bother with your arms or shoulders. This time, I'm going straight for your eyes. Or maybe your tongue. How do you think that would be, sweetie? Having a pencil driven straight through your quacking, lying t—" Her eyes flew open, and Norman's face disappeared. She closed them again and summoned Bill's face. For a moment, she was sure it wouldn't come, that Norman's face would return instead. But it didn't. "We're going out on Saturday," she thought. "We're going to spend the day together. If he wants to kiss me, I'll let him. If he wants to hold me and touch me, I'll let him. It's nuts how much I want to be with him." She began to drift again, and now she supposed she must be dreaming about the picnic she and Bill were going on the day after tomorrow. Someone else was picnicking nearby, someone with a baby. She could hear it crying, very faintly. Then louder came a rumble of thunder. "Like in my picture," she thought. "I'll tell him about my picture while we eat. I forgot to tell him today, because there were so many other things to talk about. But..." The thunder rolled again, closer and sharper. This time the sound filled her with dismay. Rain would spoil their picnic. Rain would wash out the daughters and sisters' picnic at Ettinger's Pier. Rain might even cause the concert to be canceled. "Don't worry, Rosie, the thunder's only in the picture, and this is all a dream." But if it was a dream, how come she could still feel the pillow lying on her wrists and forearms? How come she could still feel her fingers laced together and the light blanket lying on top of her? How come she could still hear city traffic outside her window? Crickets sang and hummed. Reep, 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 reep. The baby cried. The insides of her eyelids suddenly flashed purple as if with lightning, and the thunder rolled again, closer than ever. Rosie gasped and sat up straight in bed, her heart thumping hard in her chest. There was no lightning, no thunder. She thought she could still hear crickets, yes, but that might just have been her ears playing tricks on her. She looked across the room toward the window and made out the shadowy rectangle leaning against the wall below it, the picture of Rose Madder. Tomorrow she would slip it into a grocery sack and take it to work with her. Rhoda or Kurt would probably know a place nearby where she could get it reframed. Still, faintly, she could hear crickets. From the park, she thought, lying back down. Even with the window closed, Practical Sensible asked. She sounded dubious, but not really anxious. "Are you sure, Rosie?" Sure she was. It was almost summer, after all. Lots more crickets for your buck, shoppers. What difference did it make anyhow? All right, maybe there was something odd about the picture. More likely, the oddities were in her own mind, where the final kinks were still being worked out. But say it really was the picture. So what? She sensed no actual badness about it. But can you say it doesn't feel dangerous, Rosie? Now there was a touch of anxiety in Practical Sensible's voice. Never mind evil or badness or whatever you want to call it. Can you say it doesn't feel dangerous? No, she couldn't say that. But on the other hand, there was danger everywhere. Just look at what happened to Anna Stevenson's ex-husband. Except she didn't want to look at what happened to Peter Slowick. She didn't want to go back down what was sometimes called Guilty Street in therapy circle. She wanted to think about Saturday and what it might feel like to be kissed by Bill Steiner. Would he put his hands on her shoulders or around her waist? What exactly would his mouth feel like on hers? Would he... Rosie's head slipped over to the side. Thunder rumbled. The crickets hummed louder than ever. And now one of them began to hop across the floor toward the bed, but Rosie didn't notice. This time the string tethering her mind to her body had broken, and she floated away into darkness.